today, Exodus 34. And as we're looking today, we're looking at the actual renewal of the covenant between God and Israel. Now, there's some points in this record here, to be honest, as you start to read them, that would kind of leave you scratching your heads as a 21st century Christian, not understanding the why and the what fors of certain prescriptions that God will give them for godly living. And so I'm going to do my best to explain those in a context that makes sense to us. But more importantly, I want us to catch the heart of God, that God is addressing the real problem that led to the events. If you'll think about it this way, over the last several weeks, we've been looking at how Israel came to a point of being very unfaithful, even though they are still very new in their relationship with God. And so they've sinned against God. They've broken the heart of God. And there was a point here in which God has just said, enough. You can have the land promise. I told you you could have it, but I'm not going with you, because if I go with you, it will be bad for you. And Israel continues to press their plea. Moses presses their plea. And God now is restoring them into covenant. But there's something very significantly different about this time of restoring the covenant that is different than the first time that they made the covenant. And so I want you to take a look at those things, listen to those things, ask yourself some questions as we're reading along, and then hopefully I can explain them to you in a way that will give life and meaning to those things and not just leave you scratching your head. So it's a long read, but I promise my comments will be brief, and we'll move right along this morning. Exodus chapter 34, I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Please read in whatever translation you have, which is my favorite translation. The Lord said to Moses, "Cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Be ready by the morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you, and let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks or herds graze opposite that mountain." So Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first, and then he rose up early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai. And as the Lord had commanded him, he took in his hand two tablets of stone, and the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of Yahweh. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, "Yahweh, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgressions and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers to the children and to the children's children to the third and the fourth generation." And Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped, and he said, "If now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance." And he said, "Behold, I am making a covenant before all your people. I will do marvels such as never been created in the earth or in any nation, and all the people among you shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I have commanded you this day. Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and any otherites we can think of. And take care lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you go, lest it become a snare in your midst. You shall tear down the altars and break the pillars and cut down the Asherim, for you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you are invited, and you eat of his sacrifice, and you take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods." Man, is that blunt or what? "You shall not make for yourself any gods of cast metal, and you shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread as I have commanded you, and at the time appointed in the month of Abib, for in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt, and all that opened the womb are mine, all your male livestock, the firstborn of cow and sheep, the firstborn of donkey, you shall redeem with a lamb. For if you will not redeem it, you shall then break its neck. For all the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you shall work, But on the seventh day you shall rest. In plowing time and in harvest you shall rest. You shall observe the feast of weeks, the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the feast of ingathering at the year's end. Three times in the year you shall all your males appear before the Lord your God, the God of Israel. And I will cast out the nations before you and enlarge your borders, and no one shall covet your land. And when you go up to appear before the Lord your God three times in the year, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the sacrifice of the feast of Passover remain until the morning. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And the Lord said to Moses, write these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So there was with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, and he neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, he came down from the mountains. Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. Aaron and the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out. And when he came out to the people and told the people of Israel what he was commanded, the people of Israel would see the face of Moses, the skin of Moses shining, and Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went in to speak with him. Well, as I discovered in the last service, I realized that somewhere in my notes I didn't address this issue, and so I want to start off with kind of addressing that. I've had a lot of people ask about this whole issue of iniquity and sin and how those things are different, and because, you know, in Ezekiel, it makes it very clear that the sins of the fathers are not transferred from generation to generation. And so they say, well, how is it that iniquities fall on the generations, but sins don't, and what's the difference? And so sin is the things that we do that where we break the covenants. They're typically intentional, not always, but typically they are things that we have done intentionally, actions that we have made. But iniquity is, if you will, kind of the stain of sin. It's the things that follow. If you think in terms of some things that even befall people today, we know just from sociology and psychology, just trends, that people who were raised by an alcoholic tend to, for three and four generations, be affected by that alcoholism and have more of a tendency in those generations toward alcoholism than previous, than generations before the alcoholism started. We know that if someone is raised in a very promiscuous household, if their parents are very promiscuous, that the tendency will be for that child, that grandchild, the great-grandchildren of those children to have a tendency toward those same kinds of sins and behaviors. So what visits upon them is kind of a stain, if you will, of sin that affects families for generations. And we know it to be true. We have all the you know, there's no doubt about the proof of those things being a struggle for people post the actual sin itself. And so iniquities are the things that where those things affect us for generations, but no one is guilty of their parents' sin. I hope that clarifies that for you. So when we talk about the iniquity, what they're asking for is they're saying, not only remove our sin, but do not let the iniquities of our behavior fall on our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. Don't let them be affected by the stupid things that we did. Hello? Nobody wants that to fall on their children, right? You don't want the fallout from your bad decisions to fall on your children, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren. Nobody wants that. But we know it does happen. We watch the effects of those things. They're a reality. And so they're pleading with God not only to forgive them of their sin, but to make sure that the iniquity of their sin doesn't fall on the next generation or the ones after. Now, in this context here, it's really clear the genius of God in this text. In the original text, you know, in the original covenant, they were making, there's all these parts of the ceremony that are involved, and it's really a beautiful ceremony in the original, when they made the original covenant. If you want to think a lot like what we would say usually with first weddings, first weddings, people are very, you know, go to all, you know, pull out all the stops, spend any amount of money to make a very elaborate, beautiful wedding. But typically, if somebody gets remarried, they will do kind of a more, you know, subdued ceremony and not pull out all the stops because they go, well, been there, done that kind of thing. And there's a sense of difference that they're struggling with. And well, in this moment, there's all the necessary ingredients for the making of the covenant. But there's definitely a different sense of what's happening in this because it's a renewal. And it's not like a 20th anniversary renewal where everybody's going, woohoo, we made it 20 years of faithfulness. This is the renewal that says, wow, we really messed up and we lost covenant, we broke covenant, and we were no longer in covenant. And so there's not all the pomp and circumstance, but instead there's a very different feel to this moment where they are renewing the vow because it's been broken. And so it will move from ceremony to a very straightforward challenge in each one of these things that we're going to look at. And the challenges speak to the problem of their compromise and their lack of loyalty. Now, as I've been saying, as we've been going through Exodus, this is continually Israel's struggle. Israel has a real sense of identity that they get from Yahweh, and they have this sense of belonging to God, and they get all of their identity from him. And yet, they seem to struggle with the issue of faithfulness. It's all through the Old Testament. We even see it as we run into the New Testament. And even today, we see the evidence of that. How many people have you ever heard of Jubu? You ever heard of Jubu? Anybody in the room heard of Jubu? Let me, a couple of people back there are going, yeah, I've heard of Jubu. You're probably here at first service. Anyhow, but let me invite you to Google that, or Kabbalah is another one. And what it is it's syncretistic practices where they're taking other religious practices and bringing it into Judaism and changing Judaism because they, you know, it just feels cool. Jubu is where they literally take the practices of Buddhism and move it into Judaism to practice it. And it has its own style of worship and music and practices and everything. And it's really more like Jewish Buddhism. But it's more Buddhism, really, than it is Jewish. But it's becoming a widespread fad in among people in Judaism. Another common practice is Kabbalah. And Kabbalah has taken all kinds of popularity. And you know, some of the rock stars are into it and things like that. But nonetheless, there has just been a continual issue for Israel, and it's a warning to us today that about this struggle with being faithful to God, even though we get our identity from him, even though we understand who he is. But remember that even as they were worshiping that false god, when they made that idol of a calf, they called it Yahweh. They used the personal name of God and attached it to an idol. And that was what made it particularly most offensive of all in that whole situation, because they were bowing down to the golden calf and calling it Yahweh. In fact, one of the things that we know from excavations and from studies in archaeology is that we know that the practice of worshiping Baal and Asherah, which were the cultic practices of the Canaanite religions, oftentimes they would also make just an Asherah idol with no Baal. Because along the way, they thought, well, you know what? God needs a consort. He needs a girlfriend. And so they would just make Asherah, but because you weren't supposed to make an idol of God, of Yahweh, they would make just an Asherah as the wife of God. Sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't make really any sense. God says, don't make any idols. No, well, we'll just make him a wife. I don't know why that would make sense. If you already know you're not supposed to make an idol out of God, that you would turn around and make an idol for his wife. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me. But that's what they did, and we know this has just been a continual problem throughout Israel's history. So as we come to this moment, and in the context of this whole situation, the vows are being renewed, and you know, as he begins to set up boundaries for them, so that they will function in a healthy way in their relationship with God. So he makes sure that they destroy all the altars of other gods in the land of Canaan. He also makes a covenant with the people, and he tells them in a particular way that they're not to intermarry. Now, please hear me in this, because this is really important, because I hear this used this way in a lot of times, and there's just nothing more vile interpretation of this passage than I could ever imagine. This is not holy sanctioned racism. when God told the people to keep their bloodline pure, it was so that they could trace the bloodline from Adam all the way to Jesus and show how God was faithful to do what he said he would do. It is not an act of racism. And here's my proof. Moses is married to a woman who is described as being darker than the tents of Kedar. She's a black woman. And whenever they oppose her for being his wife, Miriam and Aaron oppose their marriage because it's not a pure marriage. He's not married to a Jew. God steps in and strikes them both with leprosy for their racism. Hello? So this is not sanctioned racism. Do not hear that the reason they kept the race pure was for those reasons. Because actually along the way in the bloodline of Christ, we see some people intermarrying who are not Jewish. Shh. One of them is a prostitute. Okay? So this is not sanctioned racism. This is talking about being able to track a bloodline. That's the sole purpose for it, really. And in this case, he's telling them, you know what? You've had a real problem with unfaithfulness. I mean, we're not, the ink hasn't dried on the covenant, and they're already being unfaithful. And so he's saying, look, here's the boundary lines. You can't handle this. Sometimes you and I have to draw boundary lines for ourselves in our relationship with God, don't we? There are certain things that we know of that we personally struggle with. Nobody else struggles with, but maybe you struggle with them. Maybe you have issues with the internet, and you just, it's best if you don't have internet in your home. You have it at work, you have it where you have to have it, but you just know that that's not a good thing for you. Maybe you're a person who has, you know, you just spend a lot of time on the video games. You know, the good news about video games, it keeps you from watching so much TV. Now, you know, maybe you struggle with video games, and so maybe a parent or a spouse says, you know, I think that 2 hours of video games is enough in a single day, and they set a timer on you and remind you to get off, you know, because that's not the best thing for you. It's not law or anything like that. It's just simply what's best for you. In this case, God says to them, you know what? It's you do not intermarry because you cannot handle this issue. You've been continually unfaithful in this way, and we see it play out in the course of their history. God sets up the boundaries. And then he says to them some things that are really important. He points out to them some things about their boundaries in terms of do not make gods of metal for yourself. Now remember, this is on the heels of the event where they pulled the gold rings out of their ears and the rings off their fingers and they threw them in a pot and they said, out popped this god. We don't know how it got here. You believe that, don't you? If you throw metal in a pot, out pops a golden calf. I don't know, it could be demonic. I don't, you know. No, it says he fashioned it with a tool. And so in the midst of this, God says, okay, look, this is a no-brainer. No gods of gold, not even by calling them Yahweh. Is it okay? This is not how we do this. The second thing he tells them is he wants them to keep the feasts. God doesn't need feasts. It's not like God is hungry, like God's going, you know, could you just like make some bread and bring it to my house because I'm just so hungry. It's not like God is saying, you know, I'm in the mood for lamb tonight. If I could just, if you would just bring me a lamb, that would be great. I only need to eat one time a year, but you know, I mean, no, God doesn't need anything from them, but the keeping of the feast is this way in which they stop and they take time to remember what God has done for them. It's a lot like what we do in terms of communion with the bread and the fruit of the vine. It's a reminder that Jesus gave his life, his flesh and blood for us to put us into relationship with him and that we have communion with him, that we are connected to him. It's that concrete reminder that helps us remember, not because God needs us to take some a cup of wine and a little bit of bread and have a snack in the middle of church. Like that, that's not the point at all. We completely miss it if that's it. But what it does do is it draws us into this place of remembering. Now, if you look at the history of the early church, in fact, one of the things that the early church did is they recognized this issue of faithfulness, and so they took of communion every week, not because it was law, just said as often as you do it, but simply because there was this sense of that it would ground us to the faith that we were putting our hope in Christ and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You see, that was the center of why it was done. It's not law or legalism, but it's the picture that it creates for us. And so the practice of the early church was that they had communion every week. They didn't always have a sermon. That didn't happen until the Reformation. But somewhere along the line in man's infinite wisdom, we thought it was more important to have a sermon than to remember that Jesus gave his life for us. Hello? And so he had them do these memorials to tie concretely an abstract idea so they would remember every time they ate of the bread, they sacrificed those lambs of God's faithfulness. That's why they were to keep those feasts. And then he said this really important thing: don't pollute the ceremonial rites. Now, the technical term is the cultic rites. Now, when you hear cult, immediately people go, no, 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 nothing cult for me. No, thank you. Don't want anything to do with cults. But the technical term here for those actions that are done in the temple are called the cultic practices. So if you ever read across that, like you're reading in a history book or something like that, and it talks about the cultic practices of Yahweh or the religion of Yahweh or of the temple or something like that, it's referring to those things that they did in the temple. It does not mean like a cult of personality type of thing. So in these cultic practices, the whole thing was is that he wanted them to keep the ceremonies clean and free from the other kinds of religion around them. Now, let me give you some reasons for that. First of all, just the simple fact that he didn't want them to confuse things later on. You can already see how they've begun to interject things from Egyptian religion into the religion of God. And so he didn't want them to do that. He didn't want them to defile the practices that he had already given them. Secondly, we know this just from history. Every time people are doing studies about the ancient Near East, they like to do comparative studies between Judaism and every other religion in the Middle East because they think that those things are all the same and that they all came from the same origins. And God wants to make it clear that these things that we do are not like the things that everybody else does. And so he tells them not to mix things from these other religions, in part because he doesn't want confusion later on when the second and third and fourth generation who didn't know how they got there to ever think, well, look, they're doing the same thing down the street. There must not be any difference. I don't suppose that that could ever creep in, that where people would start to think that there was no difference between one religion and another. You know, can I ask you a question? What kind of mean-spirited, deceptive God would tell everybody a different way and then require you to figure it out on your own? You see, there's a lot of warm fuzzies out there that would tell us that everything's the same, but it's not. For one thing, Jesus spoke of a physical resurrection that distinctly sets us apart from every other religion on the face of the earth. The hope of eternal life, not in some warm fuzziness out there, but in the physical, bodily resurrection. It's distinctly different from every other faith on the earth. Nothing else like it. And God set apart those things distinct, not out of superiority, not out of a need to be different, but for the single purpose of making them understand who he was and what it means to be faithful to him. He delineated clearly so there wouldn't be any confusion in later generations. And if you're wondering if that confusion would easily set in, we're not even to a second generation, and they're already having trouble. And so God sets these things out very clearly, not to be mingled with, not to be added to, so that we would never think that there was a similarity between the religion of man and the faith delivered by God. You see, there were loyalty issues, and he wants them to know what it means to be loyal. Likewise, there's an admonition not to boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now, let me tell you how that has transferred down through time and history. When you lose the point of something, you start to think that it has something to do with eating meat and cheese together. And so today, the kosher diet restricts eating meat and cheese together. And I happen to know that God loves Philly cheesesteak. No, I'm kidding. No, you know, we end up with a rule like not eating meat and cheese together. But the real point here, we know from tons of evidence, is that there was a common practice with fertility religions where they would take a baby goat and boil it in its mother's milk, believing that it was like an aphrodisiac. It would create fertility in the land and it would entice the gods to fornicate. And so the land would be full of blessing and fertility and their crops would be a big deal. That was the idea behind it. And so God says, you know what? Don't boil a kid in its mouth. And I don't care what the reason is. I don't care if it tastes good. Don't do it, because somewhere along the line, they're going to be watching you boil it at home, and they're going to watch the neighbor's kid down the street boil it at home, and they're going to offer sacrifices, and he's going to go, well, we're not any different than them. Hello? And so, in the midst of a people who were known for having struggles with faithfulness, he set about boundaries so that they didn't look like the pagan people in their religion, but had a pure and undefiled religion that was distinctly different, and said to them continually, your God is different, our ways are different, this is the way, walk in it. You know, when you have loyalty issues, you don't get stronger by going window shopping for something else. Hello? Especially not with money in your pocket. You see, what you do is you refocus on what is and you reconnect with what is. And I hear people say foolishly things like, well, we just needed some time apart. Oh yeah, I know, I've gone to meddling. But can I tell you that in 25 years of being in full-time ministry, I have never, ever, never, 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 ever, never, ever, never, 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 ever seen that work. Ever. Ever. Did you want me to make that clip? Never. It doesn't work. If you are by chance the one person who somehow survived that and it worked out for you, I'm really happy for you. But let me give you some really just wonderful advice. Don't go into marriage counseling. It's terrible advice. You don't get better by getting apart. And you don't get more faithful to God by going out and looking at what all the rest of the world is doing. You don't find your happiness in new things and in other things. You have to refocus and regather. And once you do that, you begin to see the value of what's ever before you. But the problem with Israel is she's constantly in the market. She's looking for a new God to make her healthier and happier. She thinks her teeth are going to be brighter and her hair is going to be shinier. If she just finds that new God, it will make her happier. Isn't that what the gods promise us all the time? I mean, commercials? You see, the problem is that wherever we go, there we are. Someone else will not make you happier. Some other God will not make you happier. Some new system of religion will not make you happier. It will not satisfy your desires. Not a new God, not a new wife, not a new toy. Because the thing is that satisfaction is in here, not out there. It doesn't fix the underlying problem that we all have within. You see, some people spend their entire lives running to whatever's next and new, either out of abandonment issues or lack of bonding or some other emotional or psychological wound that they have. But I can just tell you, if that's you, let me invite you to do something about it wholly different. Get some prayer, possibly some counseling. But what I can tell you is that as long as you chase those things, it will lead to all kinds of out-of-bounds actions that will cause you pain and suffering, because the central truth is that if you're looking to someone or something else to make you happy, that is by nature idolatry. That's what it is, pure and simple. You see, we will make idolatry something that happens someplace else where they have big altars and golden gods and things like that. But the reality is that other gods are constantly ever before us, and we're always chasing other things to make us happy. But the root of that word, hap, is circumstances. And I guarantee you that whatever circumstance makes you happy today, stuff happens. You've seen the bumper sticker? I'm saying it nicely. It happens. You know what that means? It means it occurs. It means you have no control over it. And if you're seeking, you're pursuing happiness, I can tell you, you will continually be disappointed because the circumstances, happenstance will happen and you will find yourself in misery again. But when we find satisfaction in our God and in the wife of our youth and the things that we have, not in the things that we don't have, when we find that real joy comes in that moment of gratefulness and pressing into what we already have, gosh, it makes all the difference in the world. But happiness, happenstance, will always disappoint us. So God strikes at the heart of their idolatry in the renewal vows. He tackles what is maybe not obvious to us as 21st century readers, but would have spoken volumes to the people of Israel in their day. Nobody would have gone, gee, I wonder why he said, don't bowl like kid in its mother's milk. There's nobody who read that. Like, you and I read it and we go, well, that seems random in the middle of this text. Didn't it? As I was reading it, didn't you think, what does that have to do with anything? But it made perfect sense in their day and time. Just like there's certain things that make perfect sense in our day and time. For you and I, that we would put boundaries on ourselves so we don't go window shopping. In the midst of it, God renews their vows and he tackles those vows in such a way that it speaks to the heart of their unfaithfulness and reminds them continually, I am faithful even when you're not. Last thing he does is God makes the face of Moses shine a glow. And I used to think, well, that's really cool. Why doesn't stuff like that happen to me? God, I want to have like glowing faces and bushes that burn. And then it occurred to me somewhere along the way, do you realize when you have a burning bush, that means that you get to lead a million grumbling people through the desert with no supplies? Anybody want that job? You just want to see a burning bush so you can lead a million grumbling, mean-spirited, angry people. Anybody want that one? No, you know what? In this situation, what happened? Moses goes up the mountain. What's the first thing they say? Oh, you know, that guy's been gone for like 40 days. We don't know what he's up to. So make us gods of gold. You see, the first thing, oh, we don't know what he's up there doing. I don't know if he's making this stuff up or what. Okay, time out. This is the same Moses who threw down his staff and like, things came out of the water, legions of frogs, and skies went dark, and people died, and things like that. If he's just a magician, I'm really impressed. But really? I mean, in that moment, 40 days, we don't know anymore where he's gone. We don't know. And so God is reminding them, when he comes down with the face shining for that 40 days and 40, there's nobody going, I wonder where he's been. They're going, have you seen his face? It shines. And every time he goes to be with God, he comes back and what? His face is shining again. And every time the message is loud and clear, he wasn't out there goofing off in the woods. He wasn't up on the mountain having a vacation. He was spending time with God. And the words he's about to bring us are the very words of God. God is reestablishing Moses so he can lead a million stiff-necked, difficult people. Again, anybody want to sign up for the job? I just want my face to glow. Maybe it's not always that cool, huh? So God does this very smart thing. You see, look at this. God sets up the renewal in such a way that it's distinctly different from the original covenant so that they remember to be faithful and he shows his own faithfulness. He sets it up distinctly different and that he points out to the things in their life that are continually leading them astray and says, stop it. And he puts his signature on the face of Moses so they don't ever have to wonder again, where has Moses been? See, I know we never say that God is dumb because you're not supposed to say things like that in church. But don't we, every time we make a decision that we know better than God, virtually say, that's dumb. God, you don't know what you're doing. This is the 21st century. We've got it all going on now. That's clearly why we're all here, because we've got it all going on now, right? You see, in all of this, God is not only good, but he's smart. He's very intentional. He's not showing off. He's leading. He's establishing. He's teaching us. And so I come to an end of a text like this, and I see several possible calls to action for my life. I see the need to deal with my own wounds and my own need for healing and seeking God for his strength, his comfort, his compassion, so that I can be made whole. I see the need to keep my eyes on God, no matter what the leaders are doing. You know, when Moses was up on the mountain, they still had the pillar of fire at night and the pillar of cloud by day. God never left their presence. When they built that idol and they bowed down to it and called it Yahweh, why did they think God had gone anywhere? But see, that's what happens when people put their eyes on human leaders and take their eyes off God. And it happens all the time, doesn't it? Well, that preacher, that elder, my Sunday school teacher, I've heard the litany of excuses. And some of the people that led me have fallen. And it hurt. But my eyes weren't on them. And your eyes shouldn't be either. Your eyes should be on the Lord. So sometimes we just need things like this to remind us. It doesn't really matter what the leaders are doing. And then the need to put into practice spiritual disciplines, whether it's the use of the feast, or maybe it's doing things like reading our Bible every day, or prayer times, or journaling, or whatever else. All those things that we do for ourselves to build into our lives reminders of God's faithfulness, of his goodness, of his enduring love for us. You know, one of the things that I know is most powerful is not for me to look at my kids and say, the Bible says, but for my kids to see that book on my lap, know that I'm reading it, and when I say, we don't do things like that. You see, the strength of it isn't in that I just quoted a Bible verse. The strength of it is that I'm the Bible. My life, because I guarantee you, one of these days, if you're not reading it and you're telling your kids all the time, the Bible says, one day they're going to find out you're lying. And then don't go blaming God whenever they don't walk the way that you want them to, but they walk the way that you walk. See, you're either disciplining them to know him and trust him, or to be as unfaithful as you are. Hello? Because I know my kids know what that Bible says. They've looked it up. They've wanted to know, did it really say that? When Dad said that, did it really say it? And I guarantee you, if they find that place where you're not telling the truth, out of convenience or tradition, they will rub your nose in it. See, I want my kids to be able to believe me. And when I ask them to read their Bibles and to walk with the Lord, I need to be doing that myself. Not perfectly. I'm not going to do that. I don't. But I want at the end of the day, when I tell my kids that this is what we do and this is how we behave, it's not because I just quoted a passage of Scripture and gave them a verse number and things like that, and they go, well, I don't know if that's there or not. See, I want the strength to be that they know that that word is how I live my life. And then whenever I say, we do and we don't do, that there's something meaningful to that. Not just empty words, not a recitation of a verse that means nothing to them. Because if it has no authority in your life, it will not have any authority in theirs. It surely won't. So the place where they find that authority of that word is that where I put those spiritual disciplines into practice in my life begins to look like the kind of life that I'm calling them to. I call them to the same faithfulness that I have. And then let that iniquity, if you will, resonate to the third and the fourth generation. Actually, it says his loving kindness to 1,000 generations of those who love him. I'll trade 1,000 generations for 4 any day. And then that last thing of just watching over our own lives so that nothing else takes our hearts captive. Have you figured out that there are so many things competing for your heart? There are so many things that say, this is the way. There's so many things that says, you know what, if you just did it this way, if you were just this way, if you had these things, if you do this, if you live in this place, everybody knows that your life gets better if you move to Florida. But I can tell you that Florida can be a miserable place without the Lord. It really can be, can't it? Bad things can happen to us in Florida. But I know this, that he is with us and for us wherever we go, but he calls us to be faithful.